Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian on my first day back after a long, self-inflicted hiatus. I'm Alex Kratosky and I'd like to thank the multi-talented Susie Weezer for her superlative work on the podcast while I was buried in books and thinking about the past 20 years of the World Wide Web. On this week's program, we're talking about the two biggest stories to hit the web waves this year. First, Google is taking steps to distance itself from China's notorious internet censorship. And second, the devastating earthquake in Haiti has inspired a rush of new media and technological solutions to the enormous social problems. We'll be tackling these stories in a few. But first, what's got internet celebrity Robert Scoble so excited?
It is impressive to be able to fly a quadcopter like that off your iPhone. It's really neat. But at what price? That's the big question.
That is Parrot's AR drone, released a fortnight ago at the Computer Electronics Show to great acclaim and clearly a little bit of excitement. Undoubtedly, it's cornered the market on Wi-Fi-enabled iPhone or iPod touch-controlled flying technology. Charles Arthur spoke with the man who invented it, a technological polymath with a rather colorful past. Charles joins us in the studio today, and with him is Kevin Anderson. Welcome to you both.
Now,
I'm curious about this technological polymath moniker.
Well, it's because, you know, technological renaissance man would just sound stupid.
That would be more steampunk.
That'd be sort of, building helicopters that, you have to put leather over the ends of and things.
Surely, Kevin, most geeks are technological polymaths. Those that I've come across have been really, really inventive.
Yeah, some they take pictures, they code, they paint their houses, they can do all kinds of things.
It's amazing what these geeks can do when they're let out of their cages,
exactly.
Isn't it? Well, keep listening for the next 30 or so minutes for these stories, plus the latest news, your views from the blogs, and all the scintillating conversation that you can handle. It's nice to be back. Last week, Google announced that it was ending its relationship with the Chinese government that had been in place since the company entered the Chinese market in 2006. The agreement at the time was that the company would allow the government to censor search results on Google's local service, google.cn. Google's latest move came in the wake of alleged cyber attacks on their services, specifically that human rights activists' email accounts had been hacked. Now, subsequent developments coming out of China has suggested that these attacks may have originated from the state itself, and that other high-profile Western companies like Yahoo and Adobe were also victims of hacks. We're joined down the line by security expert Graham Cluley, who will lead us through the latest news and what it means for Western businesses in countries like China. Graham, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, can you give us a little bit of background? We've covered it quite a lot on the Guardian site, but how is Google able to allege that the Chinese government was behind this attack?
Well, it's interesting. They haven't really produced their evidence to point towards China at the moment. But what I would imagine is that they've looked at the IP addresses, those identifying piece of information as to which computers were accessing their systems and who might have sent them the emails which ultimately infected their computers and allowed hackers to gain access.
Well, what's quite interesting, though, is that they are now investigating their own employees. So it seems that the IP addresses that they've identified may actually be in-house.
Well, it can always be useful, can't it, to have someone on the inside who can tell you about the system setup and where confidential information may be carried and what sort of computers, which people indeed should be targeted in one of these attacks. Because when a targeted attack happens, by its very nature, you don't email everyone inside the company. You email individual employees, specific people who you think might have information or might have access to information which would be useful to you if you managed to break into their computers.
Graham, the vector for this seems to have been Internet Explorer 6 running on Windows XP. Microsoft identified that as the key weakness that it can see, because it's saying that Internet Explorer 7 and 8 don't have anything like the same vulnerability. To your knowledge, is it Google in China which is running that? Because it's hard to believe that there'd be Google in California, which would be the sort of place where you'd have Internet Explorer 6 and Windows XP running together.
It's kind of funny. Shouldn't they be running Chrome instead of Internet Explorer?
That's why one wonders if it isn't the Chinese operation which was actually the vector for this attack.
It isn't clear. I mean, it looks looks like Google themselves are saying, look, our Chinese employees weren't involved in this. They weren't involved in the decision at all. We were attacked as a corporation. And I would imagine that if they were after access to Gmail accounts, they wouldn't necessarily have to target Google inside China itself. My feeling is that Google, just like many other companies around the world, may still have computers which are running later versions of things like Internet Explorer, may not be running the very latest version. By the way, although there's a lot of focus at the moment on this zero-day vulnerability in Internet Explorer, that doesn't mean that's the only element which was used in this attack. My suspicion would be there was a whole cocktail of different attacks being used to try and break into a quite considerable number of large companies who might have had information which had been useful to the Chinese authorities.
How has Google increased their mail and their other services security since these attacks?
Well, what they say they've done is they've contacted the owners of the email addresses which were compromised, and I imagine they've looked at the computers which they've identified as being the vector for infection and maybe updated the security on those. There's a lot of talk at the moment. We're seeing Microsoft urging everyone to upgrade to Internet Explorer 8. Now, although Internet Explorer 8 isn't vulnerable to the specific attacks that we've seen so far, it does also have the vulnerability in there. So there is the potential for the latest versions of Internet Explorer to be hit as well. It just hasn't happened as yet. It looks like Internet Explorer 6, which of course is quite an old version of the browser, is the one which is most vulnerable. For many people, they can't update their internet browser because, of course, there may be web-based applications which, frankly, demand that you're still running IE 6.
And this could be potentially devastating for Microsoft. I know that there are reports that the French and the German governments have recommended that people avoid using Microsoft's product.
Yeah, they told people go to an alternative browser, I guess like Firefox or Chrome or Safari.
There have been accusations that this is the Chinese government or proxies thereof, I think was how one report put it. What's the difficulty in actually assessing the responsibility, and what are some of the for state involvement, against state involvement arguments you can make as far as tracking down where the source of these attacks were?
Well, over the years, there's been real problems in identifying, you know, whether cybercrime was state-sponsored or not. We've had plenty of rumors, for instance, of attacks coming from North Korea, from China in the past, and indeed other countries. There was evidence dug up recently that the German government were hacking into Afghan ministries, and we've also seen Israeli versus Palestine sort of activities too. So, that, you know, basically, my suspicion is that everyone is at it. Everyone's using the internet. After all, why wouldn't they, to try and get advantage over each other? But it's very hard to prove that something is actually backed by the state or backed by a particular government. The problem is, it could just as easily be a teenage hacker in his back bedroom who's coordinating a denial-of-service attack or who's trying to break into a Pentagon computer. We've had the case most recently, for instance, of a British hacker, Gary McKinnon. He was just running on his own. But as far as the outside world is concerned, that's an IP address in Britain. And so they could have joined the dots together and say, oh, this is a British attack against America. So we have to be careful about pointing fingers. But at the same time, let's be realistic. It looks like the accounts which were being targeted belong to human rights activists. We've seen attacks against the Tibetan government in the past and the Dalai Lama. And of course, those aren't people who are high on Beijing's Christmas card list.
A lot of attacks are getting increasingly sophisticated, and whether these are state-sponsored or whatever, individuals' computers can be part of a larger attack, a botnet or that kind of thing. How do individual computer users make sure that as these attacks increase in sophistication, they're still protected?
So this is really essential. I mean, it's staggering, but you have to remember that over 95% of the spam which you receive was sent from innocent people's computers without their knowledge. It wasn't sent directly from the spammer's own computer. So it can be your grandmother who's pumping out those Viagra adverts and she has no idea it's going on. So it's very common these days for hackers to take over your computer, turn it into part of a botnet. This can be done by sort of political hacks like that we imagine this one is, as well as the commercial hacks as well. So you have to keep your antivirus software up to date on your computers. You have to keep up to date with your security patches, not just your operating system security patches and your browsers, but also things like Adobe. Adobe is really the new Microsoft. So we do quite often come across vulnerabilities in Adobe Flash and the Adobe PDF Reader, which of course are ubiquitous. Everyone's running them on their computers. And finally, you need a good old healthy serving of common sense, which means you don't blindly click on every link that you're sent and every attachment which you're sent.
I'd like to take this a step back a bit. There are some people who have argued that, you know, ultimately Google hasn't been doing particularly well in China. It's not the top-ranked search engine. And so ultimately, could this potentially, Graham, be a smokescreen for a bad business decision?
Well, it certainly does give them a very honourable retreat from a market where they aren't doing as well as the market leader, a search engine, a Chinese search engine called Baidu. Which itself has actually suffered at the hands of hackers in the past. But, it is possible. I don't think that necessarily makes perfect sense as to why they would want to do that. But maybe this is a way for them to get some good PR out of it after all. But I think these attacks are real. I think any company which has been attacked like this is obviously going to be worried about their commercial and sensitive information being stolen and the damage which could be done to their brand as well. So let's not forget, you know, criminal acts have happened here.
Looking forward, Google is going to be launching its Chrome OS later this year, which effectively the only ones who can change it are Google themselves. Do you think that will be less vulnerable to viruses, malware, those sorts of attacks?
Well, I think any software is going to have bugs in it, and there will be vulnerabilities. I mean, it may be well be that just like with things like the iPhone OS, the level of control Google may have over it will mean that there's less opportunities for the hackers to take advantage there. But I think what we're beginning to see is a new era of cyber attacks where it's less about actually infecting the individual computers. It's about grabbing your data. And as more and more people put their data in the cloud, I think the hackers will begin to target that instead. So it actually becomes rather irrelevant what operating system you'll be running on your computer. The attacks will be entirely web-based. They'll be taking place in the cloud as well, stealing information from you, maybe exploiting browser vulnerabilities from time to time, but actually attacking those cloud services instead. So it would be great if we have more diversity in operating systems, because undoubtedly that does make life harder for the hackers. But I do worry that there's actually a new dominant operating system which is coming into play, which doesn't run on our desktops. It runs up there on the internet instead.
Finally, Graham, do you think that this is indicative of the fact that this great Google experiment of going into this, what some people have called a brutal state, bringing the web, the great web, to bring freedom of information to these people, do you think that this great experiment has failed?
I do think Google isn't used to coming second. They normally do pretty well in most of these things. And of course, they've got that big battle with Microsoft coming up as well. The internet is fantastic. It does make information available to all. But maybe Google have stumbled, rather. You know, they're going to have to try and find some other way to open up the web to all of the people of China, I think, unless they get the cooperation of the Chinese government. And I can't imagine that happening anytime soon.
Graham, thank you so much. That was Graham Cluley. And you can read all the Google China coverage on our website, guardian.co.uk/technology. Here are the latest headlines now from stories from around the web.
The American Red Cross's Haiti appeal raised over $35 million in donations in less than 2 days, which they've attributed to social media spreading news of the disaster and appeals for money. Wendy Harmon, social media manager at the American Red Cross, described how they enlisted 30 celebrities who tweeted their appeal, and the subsequent retweets made the American text donation number a trending topic. The FBI has warned, though, that internet users should be careful to check requests for help following an email scam which appears to come from the British Red Cross. A 26-year-old man from Doncaster has been arrested after he tweeted an alleged airport bomb threat, even though it was only his followers who were supposed to be receiving his messages. Paul Chambers was held under the Terrorism Act after he joked that Robin Hood Airport had a week for services to recover from heavy snowfall, otherwise I'm blowing the airport sky high. He was eventually released on bail, while his tweet was deleted and his laptop, phone and computer were confiscated. London's Mayor Boris Johnson launched the capital city's own data store earlier this month, unveiling hundreds of data sets for free reuse. Developers are being encouraged to create mashups of the data, though some have questioned the lack of data for the London Olympics. Meanwhile, the government's expected to unveil its own site, data.gov.uk, to the public very soon. And anticipation is mounting that Apple will launch a new tablet device next week after they sent out invitations to an event to see its latest creation. The paint-splattered invitation led to speculation that creative applications would be the selling point of a tablet machine, and there were also suggestions of a new version of iLife, and even that version 4 of the iPhone operating system could be revealed next Wednesday.
Once again, it seems that social media is at its most powerful, and in fact, it's most relevant during emergency situations or during sort of live events. Kevin, how has social media and other technological solutions been used to convey information, to generate support in Haiti?
Well, it's interesting because actually the technology community has been developing this for years now, going all the way back to Hurricane Katrina, up through the tsunami. And so a lot of times what they will do, and it's happened again in Haiti, they will rally around and set up a wiki. So like Wikipedia, but basically a centralized location where they can gather information. So a site called crisiswiki.org has been part of the solution that people have been, just to collect information and sort of do some grassroots organizing of whatever resources they can do. And as we see, the situation on the ground, even with governments in the United Nations, the United States, and others, is quite chaotic just because of how significant the damages has been. Now, you're also starting to see other tools like Ushahidi, which is a crowdsourced crisis reporting tool that was developed a couple of years ago to report incidents of electoral violence in Kenya. But you actually had developers in Nairobi working on, setting up a Ushahidi instance for some of the efforts in Haiti. And what was interesting too is that they've been building out a lot of additions to Ushahidi. I mean, from the beginning, you could use SMS for it, but they've even advanced that some more so that, you know, you don't need internet access. You know, you can just, with the most basic of communication technology, get reports of damage, of where people need help, and provide some help to the infrastructure that's just been devastated by this earthquake.
Well, what I've seen most clearly is how people have used the traditional, I say traditional now, it's hilarious, you look back a year, but the traditional social networks like Twitter and Facebook, literally just to get the message out, you know, text this number and you can automatically give money to, you know, the Red Cross or to various other charities and things like that. So it seems to me that there's a kind of combination of the technologies that's really that this has really invoked. But I'm wondering if there are other advances from things like Katrina, from things like the Iranian elections, that have built on the experiences of what people were using at that time, that's new and different in this environment.
Well, one of the things that we saw during Katrina were efforts to try to have a listing of missing persons. And now, actually hosted on Google on their App Spot, is a very simple missing persons finder. Are you looking for someone or do you have information? They're just two big buttons. And to help people to find missing loved ones. So that started back in Katrina. That's when we first saw it. Again, you know, you saw it in the tsunami. You saw it in the Kashmir earthquake after that. So every time there's a disaster, and I don't want to paint this as a great thing, but every time there's a disaster, the tech community sort of, you know, does a bunch of DIY self-organization to provide as much assistance and information as they can. So as you point out, you know, this is the latest thing that we've seen. And also, I think with SMS, there's been a lot more fundraising this time, especially in North America. You probably didn't see that 5 years ago, or 4 or 5 years ago with Katrina, but you're definitely seeing that now, and the U.S. Red Cross has been able to raise a pretty significant amount of money just by those SMS-based campaigns.
I'd like to change tack just slightly and talk a little bit about this this Twitter story about the guy in Doncaster who made a hilarious joke to himself and to his 786 followers, private followers, and then was arrested. What I found most incredible was how quickly and easily the police found him. I think it was within hours of him tweeting this. So here we have, you know, the benefits of social media. We've got in Haiti, people are throwing up all this information. They're putting stuff up on wikis. They're looking for people. But on the other end, we're, again, putting up all of this information that can identify us and track us in no time flat.
I haven't seen enough of the detail to know whether the search popped up on Google, which I wouldn't have expected it to, actually, or indeed Microsoft's Bing, because they both have access to the Twitter search details. I mean, possibly there's some sort of back door there, or possibly the far simpler route is that someone just, you know, reported him for it. One of his 786 followers. Obviously, he's going to get unfollowed pretty fast.
Yeah, if
blocked.
Exactly. If you can figure that out,
he gets found out.
I mean, suddenly you actually have to talk to people as opposed to deal with social media. But hey,
talk to people in prison. Yeah. There have been libel suits because of things people have said on Twitter. There's a murder case where Twitter is part of it in New York State. It's part of the fabric of human life now, you know, that what you say on Twitter is in effect what you're saying publicly.
Well, Yevgeny Morozov, who's sort of one of I won't call him a malcontent of the internet. I think he provides a healthy dose of skepticism. And he says, you know, why do the Iranian authorities need to torture someone when they can just track them down on Facebook? And there is a point to that. And that is, you know, when we release information online, you know, it has repercussions in the West. But, you know, those repercussions can be quite severe in countries like Iran, where if you're posting a call to action on Facebook, that can get you, bring undue attention, let's say.
So think before you tweet, I think, is the final thought on this one. For more details on these stories and up-to-date headlines, then do go to guardian.co.uk/technology. His gadget was the hit of the Consumer Electronics Show earlier this month, but Henri Seydoux is more than just iPod-controlled helicopters and computer game toys. He's a technological inventor with many strings to his bow, including a successful line of wireless and Bluetooth communication devices, and a background as a journalist. Charles caught up with him and asked why he traded in a successful newspaper career to become the Willy Wonka of gadgets.
I was a very bad journalist. And so this is where I get my first computer in 79. It was the beginning of the personal computer, so I start to work as a software developer on the industry. And I work on the first startups on the early 80s. And then I start a company in 3D graphics. We write all the 3D graphics software, and I sold the company to my partner. And a few years after, I started Parrot 15 years ago.
France seems to be very big on the 3D graphics, computer-generated graphics. It's my impression there's lots of French companies, or at least there used to be, a lot of French companies that were very active there.
Yes, they were very active. The idea to make art with a computer is maybe more French than to make money with computer or industry.
The sort of carte dessinée and the Lucky Luke and the Asterix and all that.
Yes, probably, because my partner was a cartoonist. He was doing comics and an architect.
And from there you moved on to do what? You created this company which was doing 3D imaging. What was the next step for you after that?
I did a fashion business because in a certain way I'm an entrepreneur more than anything. And then I start Parrot in 94.
Do you want to just skip back and tell us what the fashion business was? Because I think people may have heard of it. Or at least the ladies in the audience may have.
The fashion business is a shoe business called Christian Louboutin. He was my friend and he's still my friend. I'm still partner with him.
Okay. And then you started in 1997, you built an electronic organizer with voice recognition. That's a long way ahead of its time.
Yes, the idea of Parrot, I still follow the main idea, which is to do new consumer electronic products with high tech. And at this time, to record your phone book, to record, you have only very small organizers. And my idea was to do everything with voice.
Was the computing power there to understand what someone was asking for?
Yes and no. The DSPs were already there, so
the digital signal processors.
Yes, we had to use them carefully. But this product was not a success, except that in the retail, the blind people were buying it. So we sell it to the blind worldwide. Stevie Wonder had one, Ray Charles, etc.
So you'd had sort of successes, you'd had a failure, and then you moved on to the mobile phone, and in particular Hans Freekit, which seems to be an amalgamation of the mobile phone and what you'd learned at Paris.
Because we start with the voice recognition. I went to the phone makers. At this time, we understand that there is a need in the car. It's very curious because the cell phone is born inside the car. And this is also what we try to do at Parrot. We are not inventors in the sense of you get a crazy idea. It's more you take the technology and you take the products and you try to transform them. So with the voice recognition, we find a way much more convenient to use a cell phone in the car. And also at this time came Bluetooth, but without a clear product idea. And on certain ways, this is good because the technology, in a certain way, it's better than you don't know what is the use. And we find this use of what we did with voice recognition and Bluetooth to do car system. And this was the first product where we had success with the company.
And moving on from there, you've looked at wireless and used Bluetooth for photo frames and for speakers.
Yes. Today, the way that you listen to music has completely changed. You don't have any more CDs. You still have, but now the music, you get it on the internet. All the music is mobile. But if you want to listen music, you need a good speaker. And also the idea that everybody that come to your place, your living room, your place, have his own music with him. Every one of your friends can come to your place and say, okay, look at this. This is a new thing I got, and play it into your living room. They operate by Bluetooth. You can connect them any phone, but also an iPod. You can dock an iPod on it. They have Wi-Fi. So you can send the music from your computer. And today, with your computer, you have access to a lot of music, including radios, podcasts, etc. So you can listen or get the music onto your computer, what you are very used to, and then stream it by Wi-Fi to the speaker. So it's really the idea of redoing the thing. Also, what I try to find at Parrot is the objects, they evolve. This is, I think, what is interesting with the technology, is to take the thing as they are, like, for example, boats. If you see the boats, if you see from an original canoe, a sailboat, you still see the original canoe in it.
Looking back over all the things that you've been involved with, you've done accounting software, you've done 3D graphics, you've done fashion, you know, luxury goods, voice recognition, hands-free kits. What's the common thread? What would you say is the sort of thing that holds it all together?
For my personal job is the software. The software is something that apply to music, apply to internet, apply to very technical software. But it's like writing or like playing music or a musician. He can write opera, can write songs. And so, you know, when you write software, you can adapt what you write to many, many subjects.
That was Henry Seydoux, CEO of Parrot Corp. You can see our coverage of his AR drone on our website, guardian.co.uk/technology. That's enough from us. What do you think? Guess what? You've been telling us on the blogs. Charles, what's been going on in technology?
Surely the most important story there could possibly be was Ricky Gervais saying that he couldn't understand Twitter, which is, sort of puts him in common with about 50% of Twitter users who give up after a month.
He's also a miserable man. So fair enough.
So like so many comedians, he's sort of following in Hancock's footsteps. But so, of course, there were hundreds of comments, which I have to say one of the ones I liked was Penny Dropper right near the end. I mean, if you're going to do 238 comments and you want to be the 236th, well, okay, you know, it's got to be worth doing. But Penny Dropper said, of course, Gervais cares so little about social networking on the internet that he needs to tell his followers about it through an internet blog. Basically the same thing, but more elaborate, and people don't get to reply.
Wah, wah, wah. I think so. Well, over on the games blog, there was a debate that was happening, which was quite exciting. Naomi Alderman asked whether people who use game cheat websites are hurting themselves, or if the people who actually don't use them are simply masochists. And it was quite a lively debate, and it was quite personal as things get on the games blog. It was really quite violent at times, if, you know, words, pen, sword, mightier than. And anyway, one of my favorite comments came from Smell-O-Vision. He said it nicely. He said, 1983, I wrote to Dominic Diamond at CNVG for a tip on how to get past something in the Lords of Time. It took me nearly 9 months for a reply, by which time I'd finished the game. That was quite amusing. And then later on he says, I'm not a bad man, and these actions do not put my guaranteed place in heaven at risk.
I gotta say, I mean, for me, Game Cheat websites, you know, I played Starship Titanic, which is the, you know, the Douglas Adams game, which is great. I wish someone would actually just, you know, reupholster that and get it to run on a modern console or platform or whatever. But, you know, the Game Cheat websites were invaluable there because they told you that there were two alternative endings. And you wouldn't have known about that otherwise. You'd just played it and never known what the alternative ending was.
No, you would have done, because some geek out there would have finished it and said, actually, you'll find that there's another alternative. Which ending
How would you have found out, you know, without
that? Well, I love, if you're a fan of the Chuck series, they've got this episode where he plays Missile Command and finds out that the way to hack breakthrough to the kill screen in Missile Command is just to listen to Rush, which is described as the music of the heavens.
Kevin, what heavenly words have you been reading on digital content?
Well, sadly, 2010 picks up where 2009 ended, which is like how fast, quickly, and what kind of paywall we should erect around our wonderful content. And you know, it's rumbled on. One of the things that The Guardian did last year, actually, in the paid content arena, was to launch the iPhone app. And, you know, we spoke about some numbers. And a good comment that I picked up on that was by a commenter named Spook, who said, it's all about added value. No one will pay to access websites on their PC. If the rumors about the Isolate are true, you can relax because you'll be able to sell a deluxe app and sell ads onto it. So the Isolate is obviously Apple's very much rumored tablet slate, you know, iPod on steroids.
My preferred name, my guest name, is iPad. Go and look at iPad.com. What is going on there?
But interestingly enough, just as we are sitting here recording this, new news about the much ballyhooed Isolate.
New news.
We've known that Apple is going to have an event next week. And there's been a lot of speculation. Is this going to be the coming out for the iPad, to use Charles's nomenclature? And they've finally said the meeting is for a special event. Come see our latest creation. So obviously there will be something new. Now, whether this is new or Isolate new, we'll see.
Or they could call it the iBook, of course, because they haven't got anything called an iBook now.
That's true.
That would be recycling, which I suppose is quite green.
Exactly. Yeah.
And they just we're in support of that.
Yeah, Greenpeace has just been nice to him recently, so he kind of, yeah.
Oh, it all works.
Green's the new black, right?
Oh, there you go. Well, in addition to all of the speculation and investigative journalism that we've been doing, which is quite good for a newspaper, I would say, we've also been reaching out to you for your thoughts on what features we should introduce on the podcast in the next few months, new year, new us. And you guys have just clearly been waiting for this opportunity. John Ellum asks on Twitter, before the general election, can Tech Weekly find out technology policies and proposals of main UK political parties, including the Greens? I like the fact that he mentioned the Greens. And definitely, I think a technology election special will have to come along. We did a little bit of coverage on that for the US election, so there's absolutely no reason why we shouldn't do that for local elections as well. John Satriani suggested on Twitter, can you follow up on some of the businesses that Jemima Kish interviewed last year for her elevator pitch? Mm-hmm. Did they sink or did they swim? I think that's a fantastic idea. And it
are
gives
they
us
in
a,
the basement? Are they in the mezzanine? Are they in the penthouse?
Do they have a corner office is what we want to know. And how much money can they, you know, kick back? Come on, hello. Mm-hmm. We got to support ourselves somehow. You may want to
corner
cut
office
that out.
Deadpool.
Yes.
But anyway, that is a really good idea, John. And I think we could definitely do something like that. I'm also keen to do some more of the this is personally I'm keen to do some more of the clinics, the startup clinics that we did last year, because mm-hmm. I think those were invaluable. And some feedback from someone who wasn't called John. Dave O'White from the University of Oxford asked on Twitter, he said something about the process of tech becoming culturally normalized. It is academic, but if it does pique your interest, and it has piqued mine, then you can read up on what he means on the Tall blog, which is tallblog.conted.ox.ac.uk. We would really like your ideas for regular features, like the road trips, like the elevator pitches, like the startup surgeries, those types of things. What would you like to see on a regular basis? Do get in touch. All the links are on our website, which is guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Many thanks to our guests on this week's Tech Weekly, Graham Cluley and Henry Seydoux. Thanks as well to Charles and Kevin, and as always, to our fearless producer, Scott. I'm Alex Kratowski, and it is great to be back in the hot seat again. See you all next week.